tonight on Arena. We celebrate the 50th anniversary of Seamus Heaney's fourth collection, North, and we have live music from the Riptide Movement. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the publication of Seamus Heaney's fourth collection, North. Here is the poet himself reading the first poem from Mossbawn, two poems in dedication for Mary Heaney.
Sunlight. There was a sunlit absence. The helmeted pump in the yard heated its iron. Water honeyed in the slung bucket, and the sun stood like a griddle cooling against the wall of each long afternoon. So her hand scuffled over the bakeboard. The reddening stove sent its plaque of heat against her, where she stood in a flowery apron by the window. Now she dusts the board with a goose's wing, now sits broad-lapped with whitened nails and measling shins. Here is a space again, the scone rising to the tick of two clocks. And here is love, like a tinsmith's scoop, sunk past its gleam in the meal bin.
The unmistakable voice there of Seamus Heaney reading Mossbawn Sunlight, a tribute to his Aunt Mary, and the opening poem of his collection North, which celebrates, as I said, its 50th anniversary this year. It was his fourth collection. He was in his mid-30s, living in Glanmore, County Wicklow at the time, and it was the first of his books to tackle the troubles directly, further exploring the bog body theme that he'd begun in earlier poems like Tolland Man. It won international awards and acclaim, but was also seen as controversial closer to home. Delighted this evening that two poets join us to talk about this remarkable collection. Anne-Marie Nicorine is with me here in studio, and Tom McCarthy joins us from Cork. That poem, Anne-Marie, like so much of what Heaney has written, the language is direct, it's straightforward, it's quite easy to understand each word separately, but it always adds up to much more than the sum of its parts.
Oh, it's an absolute gift of a poem, and what a place to begin this collection. I'd love to go back in time to 1975 and experience the excitement and the jaws just hitting the floor when this collection was published, and the bowled 36-year-old taking on this very ambitious work. And yes, he starts in this with this poem for his aunt, and it's in a domestic space, and we feel like we know the space. And
yeah,
it's
it almost harks back to the three previous collections in many ways. It's a similar feel of it.
Absolutely. It's recognisable, and yet it doesn't set us up. You know, we're about to get a lot of surprises in this book.
Yeah, and those two poems kind of sit out almost separate from the book. Anne-Marie saying there, Tom, that she'd love to go back and experience the excitement in 1975. You can do that for us.
I remember it well. I remember the day well. There were 4 days after it was published. It was published on the 9th of June, 1975. And I remember 4 days later, on the 13th of June, I met the poet Maurice Reardon in the campus in UCC. And Mossy said to me, "Have you seen the new Heaney book? It's amazing." And so I said, "No, where? How did you get your hands on it?" He said, "It's on sale in, down in the city, down in Cork." So I ran into the city, bought my copy, and was just amazed by it. Now, that early poem reminded me of poems by Michael Hartnett. I felt, my God, he's been reading a lot of Hartnett to write like that. But really, once you got into the book, it was something entirely different.
You're nodding in agreement with the Hartnett comment there, Anne-Marie.
Absolutely. I felt the ghost of Hartnett, especially in those opening pages.
Yeah. But as you said, Tom, it's when we get into the body of the book, and no pun intended there, because it is all the bog bodies become so important in what in what Heaney is exploring in this collection, or was exploring in this collection. You were a student in UCC at the time, an archaeology student. So this whole idea, this whole image of the bog people and these bodies that were preserved in bogs around the place, that must have really interested you as an archaeology student.
Oh, absolutely. I found it fascinating. And I even remember people in archaeology, the kind of tutors and lecturers in archaeology, talking about P.V. Glubb's book, The Bog People, which was about the bog bodies of Northern Europe during the Iron Age, a very important book published in 1969. And Heaney, of course, had read that book and was deeply influenced by it. But what he did with the material was what really made the poems, you know. He turned it into his own myth. In a way, he almost left the world of, say, Patrick Kavanagh and Michael Hartnett and ended up in the mythical world of Ted Hughes. And it was interesting that a month before he published North, Rainbow Press, which was owned by Alwyn Hughes, published a selection of those bog poems in a little pamphlet called, well, not a little pamphlet, a very, very expensive, exclusive, slipcase linen pamphlet called Bog People and Bog Poems. And so Heaney knew, even on the month it was published, that he had the imprimatur of Ted Hughes. And for him, Hughes was the great myth poet of Crow and Woodwow. So Heaney suddenly arrived in that territory, which was beyond us, you know.
And that mythical world, Anne-Marie, that Tom is talking about there, it also, not only was this kind of mythology of the bog people and lots of other, in other poems we'll get mentions of mythologies of the northern part of Europe, really, but he also, it not only was it mythical, it was incredibly contemporary in the way, particularly in the poem Punishment that we'll hear shortly, contemporary in the way it mixed the two, the mythical and the present day reality in the north of Ireland.
And that's one of the joys of this book, is how he moves between history and myth and autobiography. And I'm so glad that Thomas mentioned there the Bog People book, because in Stepping Stones, Heaney describes
the famous interviews with Dennis O'Driscoll. Yeah.
That's right. He describes encountering that book for the first time, and when he opened it, feeling like a gate had opened. And that's, you know, this book is the gate opening into this landscape that is so layered. And, you know, when I think of the bog, having grown up in the bog in northwest Donegal, I think of the bog as an archive, as a museum, as a keeper of memories. And it's always, it has its own animal life force. It's pushing things down, it's spitting other things up, and you're kind of subject to it. So as a kind of landscape for these poems, it's got a great texture for working with poetically.
Well, let's listen to one of those poems that does precisely what you're talking about there, pushing things down and then spitting them right back up at us, and how Heaney turns that past image into something very contemporary indeed.
Punishment. I can feel the tug of the halter at the nape of her neck, the wind on her naked front. It blows her nipples to amber beads. It shakes the frail rigging of her ribs. I can see her drowned body in the bog, the weighing stone, the floating rods and boughs, under which, at first, she was a barked sapling that is dug up, oak bone, brain firkin, her shaved head like a stubble of black corn, her blindfold a soiled bandage, her noose a ring to store the memories of love. Little adulteress, before they punished you, you were flaxen-haired, undernourished, and your tar-black face was beautiful. My poor scapegoat, I almost love you, but would have cast, I know, the stones of silence. I am the artful voyeur of your brain's exposed and darkened combs, your muscles webbing, and all your numbered bones. I, who have stood dumb when your betraying sisters called in tar, wept by the railings, who would connive in civilized outrage, yet understand the exact and tribal, intimate revenge.
Seamus Heaney there reading the poem Punishment from his collection North. We're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the publication of that very important fourth collection of Heaney's with poets Thomas McCarthy in Cork and Anne-Marie Nicoráin with me here in studio in Dublin. And you chose that poem for us, Anne-Marie. I think it's emblematic of what this entire collection does.
Absolutely. It sits very centrally. And, you know, it's not an easy poem. It's uncomfortable. It, like the bog, it kind of attracts and repels. You know, it invites me to look, to gaze at the body. And some of the language is quite sensual. And it pushes us into a corner where we almost don't want to look then. Mm. You know, so it's the looking and not looking and the tension between. And that's something that, you know, anyone who's scrolling a phone today and looking at imagery is thinking about.
And what he does in the poem, it starts out with one of these bog bodies, but it makes its way through the latter part of the poem very much into contemporary politics in the north of Ireland. And even the title Punishment is such a loaded term when you think of those times and punishment beatings and punishment killings.
And you have to remember that he did receive criticism for writing in this way, for taking the mythic and melding it with the contemporary landscape and drawing these threads between two worlds. And, you know, he said to himself, also in Stepping Stones, that the book and the poems was a lesson in standing between worlds.
It's interesting, Thomas, because I was speaking with Anne-Marie just before we came to her about this idea, particularly in the last two stanzas of that poem, I who have stood dumb when your betraying sisters called in tar, wept by the railings, who would connive in civilised outrage, yet understand the exact and tribal intimate revenge. In some ways, that standing between places is precisely what he was doing there, but he was often criticised for that, for wanting to have the best of both worlds, particularly in this collection.
I think part of the power of these poems is the ambiguity of his moral standpoint. I think that was what was so kind of morally exciting about the collection.
Life would be so simple if it were all black and white.
Exactly, exactly. So he, I mean, even across from that page, from that poem is the poem Strange Fruit, which is interesting. And it's interesting that that was Tête Coupée. It was the title of it in the Rainbow Press edition a month earlier. And he changed it to Strange Fruit, which of course has implications from southern states in America of the murder of black people. So, like, he was quite sophisticated in his thinking, and he knew, this is the amazing thing about Heaney, people get annoyed with him thinking he's made a mistake about something, but in fact he's quite sophisticated. In fact, he's very sophisticated. His thinking is very sophisticated. His reading is wide, and he's compressing all of that reading into a new kind of poetry of lines of four words and three words, and always, even despite the four words or the three words, lines of two beats, like a sort of medieval English poem, like a Chaucerian poem. Like, he's so literary with the material that is so powerfully emotional.
And I was saying about that particular poem, Punishment, it's almost like there are two parts to it, if you like. The ancient part and the contemporary part. Which,
exactly,
in fact, links into the overall shape of the collection itself. Outside of those two first poems dedicated to the Aunt Mary, which almost feel to me as if they're kind of like an epilogue to the first three collections, when we get into parts one and parts two proper of North, he's doing something similar across the collection in terms of that move from the ancient to the contemporary.
He is. He's also doing an extraordinary job of arranging a poetry collection rhetorically. He knows exactly what he's doing in the arrangement. For example, that poem, that wonderful poem Exposure, which closes the collection, was written much earlier than many of the poems in the first part of the collection. So he knew how to arrange his argument as a poet to establish his position in terms of the position of the poet in society, the position of the poet in a time of chaos and communal strife, where you would be both explaining what's happening and also giving a position. And in a sense, expressing your position is the strength in the poetry itself, you know.
What is it that, in particular, Tom, that stands out for you about the title poem in the collection, North?
I think it is, again, he's grabbing of all of the kind of mythologies of Northern Europe and of the ideas of North, you know. And the I in it is, in that particular poem, you know, I faced the unmagical invitations of Iceland. Like, what does he mean by unmagical? And then how the myth speaks to him. Lie down in the word hoard, borrow the coil and gleam of your furrowed brain, compose in darkness. Like, he is, in a way, the poet in these poems is a shaman, is a kind of priest figure who's kind of praying over the material in order to control it, you know.
Let's listen to Heaney himself reading that title poem then from this fourth collection.
North. I returned to a long strand, the hammered shod of a bay, and found only the secular powers of the Atlantic thundering. I faced the unmagical invitations of Iceland, the pathetic colonies of Greenland, and suddenly those fabulous raiders, those lying in Orkney and Dublin, measured against their long swords rusting, those in the solid belly of stone ships, those hacked and glinting in the gravel of thawed streams, were ocean-deafened voices warning me, lifted again in violence and epiphany. The long ship's swimming tongue was buoyant with hindsight. It said Thor's hammer swung to geography and trade, thick-witted couplings and revenges, the hatreds and behindbacks of the all-thing, lies and women, exhaustion's nominated peace, memory incubating the spilled blood. It said, lie down in the word hoard, burrow the coil and gleam of your furrowed brain, compose in darkness. Expect aurora borealis in the long foray, but no cascade of light. Keep your eye clear as the bleb of the icicle. Trust the feel of what nub treasure your hands have known.
Seamus Heaney reading the title poem from his collection North, which we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the publication of that collection. Poets Thomas McCarthy and Anne-Marie Nicoran speaking with me this evening. I was just saying to you there, Anne-Marie, as we were listening there, lie down in the word hoard. What great advice for a poet. And then the end of it. Trust the feel of what nub treasure your hands have known. Trust your own instincts.
I have those underlined. Keep your eye clear and trust the feel of what your hands have known. Such practical advice and such steadying advice through difficult material.
Because I know you have said and to us and in the past that this is a collection that you go back to almost as a kind of, Heaney is a touchstone, but within Heaney's work, North is a particular touchstone for you.
Yeah, it's. I go back to it because, in a way, it encourages, it gives permission. It's so wildly ambitious and it's so full of risk, you know. And it was written at a time in Heaney's life when he was just going freelance. He was expecting the birth of a child. There was a lot of pressure. It was
his
fourth
moved to
election.
Wicklow. Yeah,
and I think you can see the power, all of that energy, that fun you coming through these poems. You know, they're really daring. So, like, it's a great collection to go back to when you need to gather heart and steel yourself for new decisions.
And similarly, Thomas, would you bring us back to the kind of critical reaction to it at the time? We've touched on it. I think internationally it was jumped on and amazed at by many people, but there were very differing opinions at home.
Well, I think the local, there was always going to be criticism at home because there were such intense, both poetic rivalries, if you like, and also intense differences in viewpoints. And so he was going to get into trouble with people who had remained in Belfast. He had moved south at that time. He was criticised for moving south, for moving away from the fray, if you like. But in fact, he did that for absolutely correct reasons, because he needed to write about it, so therefore he needed to move away from it. He also was on a different trajectory from others. I remember arriving at Iowa University in 1978, 3 years after that book was published, and the wave of Heaney had already hit as far as the American Midwest, 1,500 miles away from the east coast of Boston and New York. I remember meeting a young poet in Iowa at the writer's workshop. I was doing a reading in the Prairie Lights bookstore in Iowa City, and this girl came up to me and she said that she had a signed Heaney. And I said, that's fantastic. How did you get that? Well, she said, it's not really a signed Heaney book as such. She said, I photocopied his entire book, North, and I presented it to him at a reading and he signed it for me.
Wow.
And I said, that is disgraceful. I said, to photocopy an entire book is illegal. I said, it shouldn't be done. I mean, because I was a public librarian and I knew that. I said, you can't do that. Well, she said, I told him I was absolutely broke. I love poetry and I love his poetry. And I said, I was broke on college campus, but I did have enough library credit to photocopy his entire book. And he thought that was brilliant. So he signed it for me. I thought, it was a demonstration of the kind of the eternal innocence of youth and the generosity of Heaney.
Oh well, if he was anything, he certainly generosity is a quality that would be ascribed to Seamus Heaney in bucket loads. If we can be generous with our ascribing it to him, where does this for you, Anne Marie Ní Chóireann? Where does this collection sit, North? Where does it sit in terms of the overall body of Heaney's work? Because one of the things that did strike me, we've touched on the mythological aspects. And you can, even as I was reading through some of the poems today, I could hear that interest in Greek mythology coming through as well, even though that's not Northern Europe, obviously. But that mythological connection was kind of beginning to seep in here in ways that maybe it hadn't done so much previously.
Mm-hmm. And he said of the writing process, you know, that these poems, they're oblique, they're intense, and they're fused at a very high pressure. And it really was a landmark book in that he cut his teeth and, he began to acquire his critics. And, you know, I think of it as a coming of age book as well, in that he was, you know, standing now kind of separate to some people, and he had taken the risks and they did pay off. You know, he said he never doubted any of the poems or the collection despite the criticism, and he was right because they stand the test of time.
Yeah, and I even got a sense, and I wouldn't put the words anger and Seamus Heaney together too often, but you get a sense in this collection, Tom, unless I'm misreading it, that he is annoyed at those who are criticising, not because he's annoyed at being criticised, but because they're not really understanding what he's trying to do and not giving him credit for what he's trying to do. And I think that is there in the final poem in the collection that you mentioned earlier,
Definitely.
Exposure.
There's a kind of adamant confidence in the work, as Anne-Marie has said. And in fact, it's a very good, in fact, a description of it as a coming of age book for a poet in his life. You know, he had totally matured into his own voice at this stage, and it all came together in North. So that was what was so interesting. And its success then, you see, propelled it beyond any kind of local criticism. Like by the end of that year, 75, it had sold nearly 20,000 copies. It had been republished by Oxford University Press in New York, and they republished it the following year in Galaxy paperbacks. So, and that was the paperback actually that my young poet in Iowa had photocopied. So, like, he was already in orbit, you know.
Yeah, he certainly was. Well, we'll finish up with that final poem. It's the sixth in the sequence, which has the title Singing School, and the Ministry of Fear is in there, and it's only a couple of pages away from the very infamous Whatever You Say, Say Nothing poem. Yeah. But we'll finish up with Exposure. Thomas McCarthy in Cork, agus Anne Marie Ní Chóireann and Seán Mhláthchlé. Gur míle maith agat beirt as feithic linn an ocht.
Six. Exposure. It is December in Wicklow, alders dripping, birches inheriting the last light, the ash tree cold to look at. A comet that was lost should be visible at sunset, those million tons of light like a glimmer of haws and rose hips, and I sometimes see a falling star. If I could come on meteorite. Instead, I walk through damp leaves, husks, the spent flukes of autumn, imagining a hero on some muddy compound, his gift like a slingstone whirled for the desperate. How did I end up like this? I often think of my friend's beautiful prismatic counselling and the anvil brains of some who hate me. as I sit weighing and weighing my responsible tristia. For what? For the ear? For the people? For what is said behind backs? Rain comes down through the alders. Its low, conducive voices mutter about letdowns and erosions. And yet each drop recalls the diamond absolutes. I am neither internee nor informer. An inner Amy Gray, grown long-haired and thoughtful. A woodcairn escaped from the massacre, taking protective colouring from bole and bark, feeling every wind that blows. Who, blowing up these sparks for their meagre heat, have missed the once-in-a-lifetime portent, the comet's pulsing rose.
Seamus Heaney with the poem Exposure, the final poem in the collection North, which we've been celebrating this evening with Tomás McCarthy and Anne-Marie Nicora. North has been reissued by Faber to mark its 50th anniversary. Sitting in front of me now in Studio 10 of Ireland's number one radio station are Mal Toohey on vocals, JP Dalton on whistle and guitar on his knee. We'll have to see whether we're going to get one or two instruments in this first piece, and Gerry McGarry on bass. I should say that both Mal and Gerry are sporting acoustic instruments this evening, so we'll hear what that sounds. I'm going to start with a recent single called The Old Stomping Ground.
Well, they let them from the towers out into the ring. I can still see their faces. I was only 13. Now the air, it was heavy. I can still smell the hops. I can still see the blood on the chopping block. Now me and Sean Stone, he lived up to his name, with a horseshoe in his glove and an anger in his brain. But Doyle was fast, yeah, he could duck and weave, but he never saw that dirty trick Sean had up his sleeve. And we went back to St. Aidan's for sandwiches and tea, as if nothing ever happened, but it happened, you see. Just like young Cool Cullen got his name from the hound, Sean got his on the old stomping ground. 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 Some things never leave you, comes your DNA. That's what happened here on that strange old day. Well, I'm telling you, it's over 30 years, but I still hear that crack ringing in my ear. I can still see that young lad stretched out on the floor as all hell broke loose into all the war. Now the whiskey was out, yeah, they poured it down his neck, but his jaw was in bits and his teeth were wrecked. And we went back to St. Aidan's for sandwiches and tea, as if nothing ever happened, but it happened, you see. Just like young Cool Cullen got his name from the hound, Sean got his on the old stomping ground. 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 are long gone, and so is the ring. And St. Aidan's is a little now, and them bells no longer sing. And Oilers doing odds now for dentures, I hear. And big old Sean Stone, he went back to St. Aidan's for sandwiches and tea, as if nothing ever happened. But it happened, you see, just like young Cool Cullen got his name from the hound, well, Sean got his on the old stomping ground. On the old stomping ground, 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 on the old stomping ground. On the old stomping ground, on the old stomping ground, on the old stomping ground.
The old stomping ground there from the Riptide Movement. I told you that it was Malatuhi, J.P. Dalton and Jerry McCarry. I never mentioned the Riptide Movement. That's at the top. That's who you were listening to there. The old stomping ground, you know, I was saying to you, Mal, before we started, that there's a kind of a sense of nostalgia of it. But as I listen closely to the lyrics, it's nostalgia for a pretty awful thing that allegedly happened, let's be clear.
Yeah, it's a story. We used to box when we were younger, when we were kids, and we used to have these showcase nights in different clubs. Mm. And one of them, it came back to me in a dream. I was telling the lads about it there last year. And I woke up with this dream of this vision that happened. And I asked my brother and one of the other lads the next day, who also boxed with us. I said, lads, did that really happen? Or was that a myth? Yeah. And they said, no, we were there as well. And So basically what happened, we had these showcase fights, and we were the younger lads on, so I was like 13 or 14 at the time. Yeah. And we had our fights, and then it'd go up the weights and the ages.
And the story of what happened we heard in the song.
Exactly, yeah. You know? So just...
Stuck with you for over 30 years, as you say, in the song, until you got it out. Do you know, I'm also watching you there, Jerry, on acoustic bass.
Thank you.
And harmonica.
Yeah.
And videographer. Three in one.
I'm telling you,
you're making a video as we speak here.
Well, it is. It's this kind of world we live in now that you kind of have to.
Yeah.
It's great to see you're interested in something, and a visual thing is always nice to see.
It adds to it.
We can add to this now. So
absolutely. Yeah. I was talking to you beforehand as well. You're getting ready for Glastonbury this weekend. You were there, it was 2013 and 2014, which I think you were in with me around that time.
Yeah, that's right. It is. It's 2013, we did Glastonbury, and 2014, we did it as well on the same stage. And we're going back again now next week, actually this week. Mm. And we can't wait, because it's so many amazing memories from there. And it's nice. I haven't really thought about it. Today it kind of hit me. Like, I was like coming in here and I was like, you know, I'm not ready for Glastonbury yet.
But you got a nice compliment. You were there for the Friday and the Saturday the last time,
was it?
And then what happened?
Yeah, we were asked to play the stage that look after all the staff behind the stage, the people, all the bands going through and all the artists going through that stage, all get food and watered by this beautiful, all these amazing people. Yeah. And they loved our music so much. They were like, would you mind playing a gig for us at the end of the festival for just our staff?
And
we were
did.
Like... what time are you thinking? They were like, midnight. And we were like, well, we might have a few on us, but we'll definitely give it a whirl. And they said that would be amazing. And we did. And it was absolutely class. Amazing.
I see, JP, now I think you're going to pick up the guitar. You're going to give us the second instrument in the second song.
I'll pick it up. I'll see,
yeah. Yeah, but I was also wondering about, you know, the whistle that we heard there, and you're all in the acoustic instruments. It's an electric guitar that you have there. Slide guitar, did you say it was? Or the electric?
No, it's a standard Strat, yeah.
Oh, right, yeah.
So the electric, bass load on it, but it's...
Yeah. That aspect, because I remember this wild energy which is there. Now, I suppose we're all a few years on from 13 years ago, but is there a slightly more reflective feel to the new songs that are coming out, do you think?
I'd say there is a little bit. I mean, it depends who you ask in the band, really. I like moving around on stage, so I would all just try to gravitate towards more higher energy stuff, and always would. And then I play trad music as well, though, so I try and mix both kind of together, and that kind of works for me. But I mean, look, you're right, we get older and you're looking I suppose, at different aspects of your life. And I don't have the exact same energy I had when I was like in my 20s.
Who among us has? You're going to finish up with this with the new single just recently, When the Sun Comes Up. This sounds quite positive, Mal.
Yeah. It's kind of touching on what you were saying. I suppose, like, we are together as a band now 19 years, going into 20 years. Mm. So, and I think a lot of our themes and our songs revolve around time and the fascination with time. And this song, I think, sums that up, because it's a nostalgia for the past, and it's about trying to live in the present. And even the song, the recorded version, if people want to check it out, we purposely sped up the song throughout. So the BPM was start off at 156 and it ends at 164, so it's to give that idea of time
speeding up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, so, okay, off you go and give it to us. So
I just had to give one quick plug as well. I'll be playing a very special festival, and we're doing Kaleidoscope and Glastonbury, but in it's a kind of one-off performance on July 24th at the Percy French Festival, and it's a festival that celebrates Percy French. And if anyone wants to go out or check it out, it's percyfrench.ie.
Fair enough. Yeah. Let's hear then the new single, When the Sun Comes Up.
I must try to better my life. I only last a week, cause my heart's not in. How can I pretend when I'm with all my friends, a burst into life? In this council house where we're all living, and this could be your last. I just seem to figure it out, yeah, I can figure it out. So let's go back to yours tonight, for one last drink, for one last time. We'll stay up all night for old times, until the dawn it breaks, until the sun comes up, until the sun comes up. I've had to learn through the course of my life, but I don't regret those bad decisions. What did I expect? The joy of casual sex. I'm working in an office, it's got a pension plan and healthcare cover, and this could be your last chance. I can't seem to suss it out, no, I can't figure it out. So let's go back to yours tonight, for one last drink, for one last time. We'll stay up all night for all time, until the dawn it breaks. We'll dance the dance of the living dead. Yet years are short, but like I just said, there's no pretending the truth.
truth sinks in. When the drugs wear off, will it still make sense? When the sun comes up, when the sun comes up, when the sun comes up.
When the sun comes up from the Riptide Movement. Glastonbury this weekend, Kaleidoscope Festival in Blessington in July, Forest Festival in Leash in also in July, Waterboys in Limerick in August. RiptideMovement.com for full details. A new theatre piece from activist, writer and performer Noel Brown and architect and performer Camille O'Sullivan explores the history of the mother and baby homes in Ireland, but through an unusual lens, told through story and song. In Plain Sight tells the story of the incarceration and neglect of thousands of women in Roscrea, Castle Pollard and Bessborough mother and baby homes by looking at the history and architecture of the buildings in which they were housed. Mid-sized mansions started out as family homes, albeit very grand ones. Delighted to be joined in studio this evening by Noel Brown and Camille O'Sullivan. It's not like a play, Noel, before we can, it's almost like documentary theatre, and what you're doing is you're looking at these buildings and saying, here's what they look like from the outside, not quite the experience from the inside.
Absolutely, it's that hidden world, and it's a kind of an exploration conversation, inviting the audience to reflect with us about the, you know, the unresolved history that's there.
Yeah. I was amazed, Camille, because I thought, I know both of you separately, and I didn't realise that you actually had quite a big connection.
Oh, massive.
And that's how this...
Cork, first of all. Now, we've tried to hide our accents tonight, so it would be like that with you talking. But Noel, really good friends with my big sister, Vicky, and Noel was one of the first... I went to school in Ashton, and one of the first plays I ever did on stage was when Noel, she was absolutely incredible in Desperate Brides Again. And one of the reasons I wanted to become an actress. Yeah. And it's not funny enough, but I didn't really know what she'd gone through until recently. So that was another, but it was just amazing. So yeah, ourselves again.
Were the first person when I had the idea about focusing on the buildings itself. I was thinking, who do I know is a really good performer and also happens to be an award-winning architect.
Yeah, so you can get her to look at the architecture.
Absolutely.
In a way. And Camille, touching on it there, your own experience with the mother and baby homes and with trying to find out your own birth origin and your birth mother. That's part of what has fed into this, although you have dealt with that partly before, haven't you?
I have. I mean, it's not really my story in there. If anything, it's a story around the activism and campaigning that I've done over the years and my responses as a performer, because theatre is such a great platform, which I learned in 2013 with Postscript. So it's finding another way to keep the conversation going and to invite audiences to have a think about what's going on, where we are now and what we're going to do, essentially. But I couldn't stop thinking about the buildings, and I've always been interested in what histories are in the walls of buildings. And that was why I thought, well, I have no memory of being in Bessborough, but I want to know what happened within those buildings and, decisions that were made.
Is there a unifying architectural tone, if I can put it that way, to these buildings, Camille?
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing because I'm coming in, like, I'm learning something every day, and it's kind of, I'm emotionally on a... hearing this story, but also coming through this lens is really interesting because, you can tell the story again and again, but if you're looking at through the lens of how the church bought these kind of what the great historian Maurice Craig called middle-sized mansions or stately houses of Ireland, they're all of similar size. They're all kind of buildings that would have been, like, if there was two major monuments of the town, one being the church was the gatherer of the community, and then where the king and queen of the county lived was in this beautiful house. And all of these houses kind of it's where the power lies within the house, but also the design of them. They're all designed based on classical Roman and Greek architecture. And something I was fascinated as a student was this mathematical ratio called the golden section, which is the idea of it's used in art and music and in architecture. And it's about the idea of the perfect beauty. So in a sense, these buildings already have like a theatrical facade that acts like smoke and mirrors. They present
perfection
to the community, but you don't know what's going on inside. So in a way, this awful things that happen inside, it presents one face, and it was like a perfect place for them to have chosen. Yeah. And each one of them is similar, you know, and I suppose with the people that visited them having their cups of tea with you know, the Mother Superior General, they would have had one facet to it. Yeah. But then what happens behind, you see how they used architecture as a weapon. Yeah. And how they, it was a cold, desolate a world where, you know, you shows that the added on parts to those beautiful buildings was really about the oppression of the people that lived there. So that's the fascination, you know, for myself.
And I know you both grew up close to what was a boys' orphanage in Passage West.
Well, that's me. Yeah.
I grew up near Besborough.
Clearly. But you then visited, which I find extraordinary, Noel, that you visited. Was it Shan Ross, we all know via the Philomena Lee story? Mm. That must have been an incredibly, what type of experience was it?
Yeah, well, I visited the three buildings that we focus on. I visited Castle Pollard as well, Shan Ross, and got some access to Besborough, but not very much. But they are, you know, it's chilling, you know what I mean, is the only way to describe it. And I didn't know how I would feel as a survivor going in there, but also as an artist trying to focus on looking at the buildings and, you know, and examining them for the, you know, to get a sense of what I wanted to put into the piece. But it's a very strange experience, you know, and I think even if you didn't know what went down in those buildings, I think just the atmosphere sometimes really affects you. But I found it really hard, to be quite honest.
I can imagine. And I was also struck by the nature of the letters that were written at the time these buildings were being taken over by the church or whatever particular group of people were going to run the homes, the kind of language that was used to describe the women that were inside that would be inside.
Yeah, second-class penitents and a residue of women and, you know, second offenders and all of those. And the language is appalling and it's really chilling when you read it. But also their focus on wanting the beauty in their quarters, you know what I mean? They wanted French polished and, you know, Japanese oak in the pews in the churches, and then shrinking the baby baths, making them smaller so they would spend less money. And that's when you see it in cold, hard writing. It's extraordinary, the tone of those letters. It really is.
I've mentioned Philomena Lee, whose voice will be part of this performance. How will that work?
Well, her testimony will be part of it. Yeah, she's amazing.
This was the testimony that she gave as part of
Home Part One, actually, the Abbey production that we did in response to the Commission of Investigation report.
Yeah, and the Commission of Investigation report plays large within within this piece of theatre as well.
Does.
And I get the impression of dissatisfaction, to say the very least.
Completely. It was beyond offensive. I mean, particularly around the testimonies of survivors, you know, taking them and cutting and pasting them and truncating them and taking them out of context. It was a really huge breaking of trust for survivors. And it was, you know, nearly ran to 3,000 pages and 11.5 million was spent on it. Why that couldn't be done without that a prejudiced view being put into it all the time. It's chilling. And some of the language in there is pretty chilling as
Two
well.
Two other women that play for Philomena Lee is mentioned. Katrina Crowe is mentioned
within
the National Archives.
International legend. She is.
And what are we getting from her testimony?
Well, she was part of the research and development early on, because I've been working on it for a while. And just the overview, while we have the details of the very specific places and what happened, she has the overview of the machines of power, essentially, church and state, and how they operated, and how the Catholic Church latched on to the state in 1922, which is when Besborough was bought by the Sacred Heart Nuns.
One other woman I don't want to mention, because it's so unusual to get this, and we should grab on to what positives we can, is a woman called Alice Litz. Webster?
Yes.
Mm. Yeah. From the period, from the 1930s.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Who amazing. Called, who blew the whistle.
Mm. She did. Weirdly, her name came up in the Commission Investigation Report, which highlighted her essentially. Mm. But very little is known about her. But she wrote some very fearless reports about the state of the institutions where
women... Surprise, surprise. She wrote fearless reports and very she little sure is did. Known about her.
Yeah, exactly. I couldn't even find a photograph of her and I checked everywhere.
It's very beautifully told because, like, I'm a watcher too, you know. I love your writing and I love you as a person since I was young and I feel protective. Yeah. But wow, it's not hitting people over the head. It's really told sometimes factually, sometimes down to earth, sometimes through song, sometimes through polishing. So it's done in a very, I don't know, it's kind of you're lured into it. But I think it's a very a thoughtful and provocative.
I must say, just in finishing up Noelle, I noticed that at the end of it, the character, in inverted commas, of Noelle is exhausted. And I'm not surprised, I presume. That is more the feeling after going through all of this than anything else.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, you've got to keep going as well, you know.
And she will.
We'll get justice yet.
Thanks to both of you for coming into us this evening.
Thank you so much.
Noelle Brown and Camille O'Sullivan. And In Plain Sight, wonderful title as well, is at the Sacred Heart of Mary Convent in Roscrea in County Tipperary, not far from Sean Ross, but not in Sean Ross, from the 8th to the 12th of July. Tickets and information from the sourceartcentre.ie. And that is our lot for this. Is it Monday? It is Monday. It is Monday evening. I'm going to forget people's names now. Is it Ollie Hamilton? Paul Barnock, Marnock was on sound. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator and tonight's programme, Paulie Shields Research. And tonight's programme, I remember this one was produced by Sinead Egan, who just told me all those names in my ears. Thank you, Sinead. I will speak to you once again tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RTÉ Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.